elective surgeries are on the rise again following a downswing during the COVID era. Yet, with this rise in these procedures, there are challenges and issues involving documentation of these surgeries that we should consider and will be addressing. Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm your host, Dr. Tomas Villanueva, Senior Principal for Performance Improvement Consulting and Practicing Internist. Today, I have a returning guest, Rachel Mack, who provides some facts about documentation for elective procedures. Rachel, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Tom. Thank you.
So remind the listeners about your background and what your current role here is at Vizient.
Of course, Tom. I am a consulting director of CDI here at Vizient. And my teammates and I work closely with what I call all aspects of the CDI food chain, including CDI specialists, coders, CDI leaders, quality leaders, and executives to improve the goals of their program, whether that be improved finances, CCMCC capture, case mix index, decreasing ODE ratios, length of stay, improving risk-adjusted outcomes. We really do it all here with Vizient and CDI.
And it's always a pleasure working with you.
Thank you.
So we all know that elective surgeries are on the rise after the pandemic, but what are some facts about elective surgery that maybe some of our listeners might not be aware about?
Yeah, Tom. Calling something an elective surgery is a little bit of a misnomer, which I will get to shortly. But simply put, it indicates that these surgeries are scheduled in advance and do not count as emergencies. Urgent or emergent surgery, which is honestly probably how a lot of the population feels about all surgery, this is for acutely ill patients who experience some type of event, right? A fracture, a myocardial infarction, a perforated bowel, something like that, that are emergently admitted to the hospital and then ultimately taken to the OR within a few hours or a few days of their admission. An elective surgery is a surgery to address a health problem that is not immediately life-threatening. Now, notice I said immediately here very carefully. These are significant and severe health conditions. They just aren't likely to negatively impact the patient anytime soon, but they ultimately will if they don't do anything about it. The five most common elective surgeries that older Medicare age adults considered were joint surgery, eye surgery, abdominal surgery, cosmetic surgery, oddly enough, and then foot or some leg related surgery. And adults age 65 plus, they are more likely than adults ages 50 to 64 to have had an elective surgery. That's 73% versus 57%, as were adults who were retired or not working compared with those employed. So based on the research, two of the biggest concerns for patients making the decision to have elective surgery, and this should probably come as no surprise to anyone, but are pain and then unexpected out-of-pocket costs. That number I just explained where Medicare patients have more elective surgery, you know what? It might be because these are mostly paid for. And patients who are not on Medicare, who are on commercial insurance, still working, they may put off these surgeries until they get Medicare, until they retire, which is really unfortunate. But pain and unexpected out-of-pocket costs, again, may have patients put off somewhat dire elective surgeries until they require hospitalization, until it's acute, when that disease process really just cannot be managed in the outpatient space anymore. So elective surgery, again, it's one of those things a lot of people don't know anything about until they need to have it. And then they start researching. And again, unfortunately, a lot of patients put it off.
You know, Rachel, I couldn't agree more because I tend to see this in my own practice, specifically on patients that tend to have higher deductibles. They'll hold off on care or having a procedure done until pretty much they just can't tolerate whatever issue is going on. And you're right, many of them may hold off until they're in Medicare. I understand that there are specific areas, but I'm thinking that there's something else that makes elective surgeries unique other than the areas you mentioned about.
Yeah, so elective surgery is, and unique is the perfect word. It's unique for a variety of reasons. First off, because it's planned and because there's usually plenty of this preparation time, this allows the surgery team and the surgeon to truly and appropriately prep the patient. So what do I mean by prep the patient? For patients with chronic conditions, which a lot of our population has, not just our Medicare population, but for patients with chronic conditions like diabetes, heart failure, COPD, et cetera, they can be correctly medication prepped. So for instance, for our CHFers, their medical team can ensure they're on the right medications, that their labs like BNP and potassium levels are normal, and that their fluid status is euvolemic prior to surgery, which all of these things That allows the surgeon to have the best and healthiest version of that patient when they're on the operating table. So again, for our CDI listeners, you're looking probably for these patients in hopes that everything goes well, a chronic specified CHF. That's what you want, well-documented prior to surgery. And again, if they've got that well-documented, they're prepped appropriately post-operatively, the hope is they don't have those bad outcomes and don't go into an exacerbation.
So Rachel, you're bringing up a very good point, because the most common cause for post-operative complications in an elective procedure is actually not maximizing the care for any chronic condition, or it's the perioperative evaluation. Can you emphasize a little bit more for our CDI folks on what exactly they need to concentrate or even try to capture?
Absolutely. So for our elective, again, for any surgery patient, right, but especially for our elective surgery patients, you may not have MCC opportunity like you do on your urgent emergent surgical patients, right? They come in, I won't say healthy, but they come in healthy-ish. They come in healthy for them. So from a CDI perspective, from a quality perspective, from a coding perspective, we are looking to get, and I hate to say, because we have to be kind of choosy beggars in CDI sometimes, right? But we are trying to get all of those chronic conditions as well documented as humanly possible, either in the H&P that's done in the hospital or in that outpatient H&P. Because Tom, you all know, a lot of surgeons, they don't really do an H&P, a tried and true H&P for these patients, right? It's basically saying, see my H&P from a week and a half ago, which is fine. We just want all of those chronic conditions the patient has as well documented and specified as possible. Because a lot of those for these patients, especially our Medicare patients, that is going to capture a comorbid condition or a CC, which is great. That patient having that CC that tells the world this hospital is taking care of sick patients at their baseline.
Can you give us an example and say, I commonly do perioperative evaluations on things that I need to be very cognizant of documenting?
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. So a couple of examples off the top of my head, diabetes. A lot of the diabetes codes may not get you a CC or an MCC, but the magic words for patients that are experiencing hyperglycemia or hypoglycemia, those are the magic words. Diabetes with hyperglycemia, diabetes with hypoglycemia. And we can code both, by the way. For Medicare patients in U.S. News and World Report, that gets you a more complex diagnosis, a more complex code for that patient. And it should. It says that they're sicker than someone who has diabetes without any complications, right? So these are our patients. They have elevated blood sugars at their baseline. They're on some type of insulin dosage at home. And usually their hemoglobin A1Cs, I don't have a magic number because I'm not a physician, but they're usually higher than 7, right? No matter what we do. Doctors ask me all the time, do I need a blood sugar greater than 200? And I say, no. If they've got a hemoglobin A1C of 7.6, that is diabetes with hyperglycemia at their baseline. That is what the research tells us. So that's a great topic to diagnose and document correctly. Another one is CHF. I just mentioned it, but it bears repeating. A chronic CHF with preserved EF or with reduced EF. Also, a patient can have both. A patient can have a CHF with reduced EF and grade 1, 2, 3 diastolic dysfunction. That's going to get us that combination chronic heart failure code. Another couple off the top of my head, if you're a patient, and I take this very personally because I have adult onset asthma, but if you can get their asthma specified as mild, moderate, severe, that would be fantastic in the documentation. Again, these patients, even young ones, are at higher risk of having those respiratory conditions after surgery. So those are a few off the top of my head. I might come up with a few more as the podcast goes on, but those are some great ones to put in your back pocket to get well documented.
You know, out of curiosity, we've mentioned that our patients are older, they're sicker, but they're also heavier. And I'm seeing a lot more of obesity and obstructed sleep apnea. Is that important part of it?
That is a fantastic one. And it's so easy to document at this point in our existence in 2024. All we have to go on is BMI. So if your patient has a BMI and they're not a bodybuilder, which Tom, I would wager to say most of our patients are not bodybuilders. If they've got a BMI greater than 30, so between 30 and 39.99, documentation of just obesity. You don't need any other specificity. That's what they meet criteria for, obesity. And if they have OSA, definitely document that. Then we've got our patients that have BMIs greater than 40. And that is technically meeting the criteria for morbid obesity. Another synonymous term for that, if you like this one better, is class 3 obesity. they will both code to morbid obesity. But documenting morbid obesity along with the patient's BMI, that automatically will capture a CC or a comorbid condition. And another piece, you asked about the obstructive sleep apnea, a great one to loop in. This is a challenging one to get physicians to document in the inpatient space, but it is OHS, obesity hypoventilation syndrome. Used to be called Pickwickian syndrome. I think some physicians still call it that. These are patients, there's very strict criteria for meeting it, but they're strict but lenient, right? So they have to have a BMI greater than 30. They have to have an already diagnosed obstructive sleep apnea, and they have to require CPAP or BiPAP at night. That's it. That's all there is to it. And both morbid obesity and OHS will capture that CC for that patient as well. So excellent question, Tom.
That's great information. And I look forward to continuing our discussion on the next episode. And to our listeners, you can contact Rachel at her email address posted in the research section. And if you have any additional questions pertaining to modern practice or simply want to send us your comments, please contact me at our email, modernpracticepodcast@vizientinc.com. And please join us for other Modern Practice Podcasts. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. And now, I'm Dr. Tomas Villanueva. Thank you so much for listening.